Well, happy pre-Thanksgiving. Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. There's a full show, and I can't remember having a full show during this hawk season, but I hope you will stay tuned throughout it. If this had been on for the last 15 minutes, you would have heard my guest, Charles Troy, who's one of the most interesting people I know. He and I were talking politics, but we're not going to talk politics now. Charles, it's great to see you again and have you back, and it's great to meet your lovely wife, who's sitting here, too.
Thank you so much, Rick.
You are, let's tell people, because you're going to be on for the whole hour, let's tell people a little about your history. You wind up going to the University of Michigan to study what many years ago?
Well, I wanted to study writing an original musical. That was my mistake. I lived too close to Northwestern, so I didn't want to go. And I looked at Michigan and I saw, oh, hey, they've done original musicals the last 2 years. Great.
You first explored that passion in high school, though, did you not?
Correct. I discovered how fascinated I was with musicals, and I wrote the first student-written show at Evanston High School. It's called Yamo. Up until then, it was a talent show.
Yeah.
I've told people that, yes, I was really the one who did it first. And I will say that to my dying day.
Well, you should, as well. You should. Well, what was the seed of the passion in the first place? Did you attend a lot of musical theater as a kid?
No. On a Saturday night as a freshman, and who had anything to do on a Saturday night as a freshman?
No kidding.
So there I was sitting in my kitchen and somehow fiddling with the FM dial of the radio and happening on to a show called Original Cast or Opening Night or something like that. And they played this original cast album. And it was November of 1959, and the show was Fiorello.
Wow.
It had just opened. It had just been pressed. And I just sat there and listened for an hour, absolutely captivated, and thought, wow, listen to how this tells a story in such a witty and informative and melodious way, and I just couldn't get enough.
Did you play any instruments as a child?
No, I liked to write verse, you know, yeah, light verse.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my connection with it, not the music so much. I'm really kind of not a very sophisticated musical person. If something sounds good, it's good to me.
Like you know what you like.
Yes, exactly.
You know what you like, in other words. How was the show in high school?
The show went very well, and it's still student-written today, and I just had an exchange with somebody last Wednesday when I was in Ann Arbor, and she said, oh, you're from Evanston. I said, yes, I wrote Yamo. She said, wow, Yamo, wow. You know, and she started telling me all this stuff about Yamo now. And
when you decide to go to the University of Michigan, which is not an easy school to get into, even with the ETHS background and that fine education there, what'd you major in?
English, yeah.
And you were going to sneak in some kind of musical stuff, right?
There was no major in musical theater at the time. This was long before. I mean, we're talking 63 through 67.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the 80s that there became programs in musical theater, and now almost every school has something like that. I could have certainly majored in it had I been born 20 years later.
But you write a show in Michigan, yes?
Yes. It turned out that my senior year happened to be the sesquicentennial, which means 150.
Yes, of course.
And so there was suddenly a contest for an original musical, and I thought, oh, it looks like if I win this, I get my original musical after all. So I wrote it. It was accepted and was performed 10 times at Michigan, beginning the day after the big snowstorm of January of 67.
Remember it well.
Man. Oh, yes.
The biggest snowstorm in the history of Chicago.
Wasn't so good in Ann Arbor either, let me tell you.
I'll bet. How's that show hold up?
There are still things in it that I like very much. There is a song that I have sung to and maybe almost taught my granddaughters. In my research, I found out that I wanted this to be a show about the university and some of the background. So in doing my research, I found out that in 1871, The university was looking to import a president from the East, you know.
Sure, of course.
The sophisticated East to make Ann Arbor and the University of Michigan a legitimate school. So they tap this guy, and he comes out and takes a look, and he sees the president's house, and he says, okay, I'll come under one condition. Yeah? We need indoor plumbing in this. In the president's house. So they built him a toilet, and he came.
And he came. That was it. And that was his perk.
And that's it. And so I thought, this is too good to resist.
Oh, absolutely.
So I write a I was very influenced by Cole Porter at the time.
Sure.
So I wrote a Cole Porter comic duet called Indoor Facilities, where two guys who were putting in the plumbing talk about plumbing in the history of the world, you know, and how the world got along fine without
funny.
It. And then Wednesday night, I'm in Ann Arbor to do a show, and I was introduced to the president of the university. And so, of course, I couldn't resist. I told him the story. Did you know that the house that is the president's house?
It's still the president's house. It couldn't be. They had to do some renovations or something.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't know if he actually still lives in it or if it's just ceremonial.
Yeah.
Hey, Trump's not going to live in the White House, is he? I don't know.
His wife and kid are not moving in right away.
Right, right.
So. That's a great story. So you leave. I want to get this done so we can talk about what you do now. You leave and you decide, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to make it in the musical theater business.
That was my hope. And I found there was a particular workshop. It was the first of these. You know how there are screenplay workshops all over the place.
Now, yeah.
Right. And even then. But there was nothing like that for musical theater. But this guy named Lehman Engel had kind of figured out what the patterns were of successful musicals. And that's what he taught to would-be lyricists and composers. So I enrolled in this, or was accepted in it, and spent a year and saw all these very talented people who were 15 years older than I was and hadn't gotten anywhere. And I thought, And plus, Hair had just opened in April of 68, and I thought, if this is the future, this is not the kind of show I can write. So I tucked tail and came back to Chicago and joined the family business. But there is a little twist to the story, because all these people who were unsuccessful, I thought, okay, they're very good. What chance do I have? And then this fellow, Lehman Engel, brought this one guy who was a star pupil in to play for us for one afternoon, basically to show us what was possible. It had the opposite effect on me. I thought this guy was the most brilliant guy that I have heard besides Sondheim in the last half of the century. That he was that good. And I thought, if he hasn't made it, then what in the world am I doing here? What chance do I have?
Who was it?
He did go on to write the lyrics for A Chorus Line.
Did he really?
Yeah, his name was Edward Kleban, and he had personal issues. That was his only show, but there was a show about him called A Class Act, which played at Porchlight a few years ago and was terrific.
What a great story. You are listening to the life and times of Charles Troy, who those early life and times pale by comparison with what he's been doing over the last few years. We'll explore that, and we'll hear some music, because he is he's one of the most accessible. When you hear the phrase musical historian, the first thing that flashes in your mind, I think, is academia. Charles is a scholar, but he is the most accessible scholar in this realm that I have ever met. I hope you take that.
Thanks so much,
as a praise.
Absolutely.
That is the thing that distinguishes you, because I know a lot of musical scholars, and they could not do what you do. You'll find out what he does after a short commercial break. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, and my guest, Charles Troy. We have gotten Charles out of New York. He has seen Hair, he has seen talented people, and he has said to himself, perhaps wisely, because I don't think he carries a lot of regrets because of what he does now, but he came back and went to work for the family firm for a time.
18 years. Long 18 years.
And then you became, if memory serves me, you got into the relatively new field of graphic design, right?
Right. Lauren, my wife's brother, was a hobbyist. in this strange new field of what was called desktop publishing.
Right, sure.
And he had a big new Mac with a big screen. And I thought, okay, I used to be a creative person. Let me just kind of wander through this and see if there's anything there. And I was intrigued, and I had never done anything graphically. I'd written lyrics. I'd written stuff that I considered witty. And what I realized was that you could do wit through visuals.
See, I think with you, you're one of those rare people who has and has pursued and been lucky enough to pursue. I think everybody has a creative urge, whether it's, you know, the first caveman to do a drawing on a wall or something. It's in everybody. And you were lucky enough to sort of stumble upon it when you heard Fiorello on the radio, mm-hmm. and then again when your wife's brother had a computer and you were able to exercise and explore your creativity.
Well, it sounds impressive. What I really was desperate. I stank as a businessman, and I thought, I got to do something else with my life. And fortunately, I was able to make a deal with my brother that gave me a little financial cushion to explore what I might do next. And I discovered this, and I just made decisions that worked out from then on.
And in a sense, though, and remind me, I've written about you some years ago. I can't remember how long ago, but you have ever stuck with me. You kind of stumbled upon your new life and career when you were working or doing graphics for some retirement home. I don't remember what it was.
Senior Learning Center, which no longer exists.
Right.
In Northbrook, and they had this catalog, and the catalog had all these classes on musical theater. And I thought, well, I can do that.
You know? Yeah, I can do that from the Sun and Chorus Line.
Yeah, there you go. Back to Ed Kleban again.
Was it really that immediate? You said, I mean, that's like a lightning strike to my mind.
It had actually been percolating for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And the percolation started with a show called, the show Ragtime.
Yeah.
Which came to Chicago, and I decided to investigate it. And I had not been involved with musicals for decades. And when I listened to the CD, I was so blown away by the songs, remembered the novel, Doctorow's novel,
sure.
and how brilliantly Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty adapted the themes from Ragtime. And I suddenly had this urge to tell people about how it was done. And when I found out that they had been members of the same workshop that I was years later, I structured this as like a series of assignments from Lehman Engel. Write a musical scene based on this page,
sure.
You know, et cetera. And that's what they did. And they just did it successfully all the way through. And that's how I framed my presentation. And I thought, this is cool. And then I put it down. And then 5 years later, this thing came along with the Senior Learning Center, and off I go.
That's pretty amazing. How many you do also, and we're going to get into some of the, because it is the season for it, you do a number of presentations about the history of musical theater, such shows as, I can't even remember now, but, you know, Oklahoma, some of the Cabaret, The Sound of Music, West Side Story, Chicago, which has a lot to do with Chicago.
And this building.
When did you started with theater, doing these mm-hmm. presentations, mm-hmm. and then I can understand the logical leap to, well, it's Christmas time, maybe I should look into this.
Actually, it was presented to me. A friend who was at the time producing at the Wilmette Theater suggested, why don't you do a Christmas show? And suddenly, immediately, this idea came to me. What had happened was I had done a four-part series on Irving Berlin several years before.
Yes.
And in reference to one of his greatest songs, White Christmas, I had discovered this particular book, which I'm holding right now, which is called White Christmas, The Story of an American Song by Jody Rosen. And I found the book fascinating in terms of explaining how White Christmas was written. But more than that, because Jody Rosen had this premise that he elaborated on, talking about how White Christmas was so successful that it basically triggered the era of the popular Christmas song, which had really not existed before. Christmas songs were all religious.
I must tell you, Charles Troy and I absolutely share this passion for, because I discovered this very same thing because I was assigned, I guess, a piece about Christmas music around the very time that you were doing that first show, 2011 maybe, or
yeah,
whenever
exactly.
it was.
2011.
So I consulted my friend Ron Penn, the music professor at the University of Kentucky. And I came to realize, first of all, it may not be true, but I'm ever taken with the notion that the maybe apocryphal story that Irving Berlin wrote White Christmas like sitting poolside in Beverly Hills or something. That may not be true, but I love that story. And about this unbelievable explosion, ladies and gentlemen, virtually, and tell me I'm wrong, Charles, virtually every song you have been hearing on one specific radio station and will hear throughout this season were all kind of, the majority of them were all lumped together in this explosion of Christmas music.
Right, about a 10-year period after 1942, which is when White Christmas made its mark. There had been a couple songs written before that, and they had had some airplay and sold some sheet music, but they didn't really trigger anything. And the first one was Santa Claus is Coming to Town in 1933, and the year after that, Winter Wonderland. But they kind of sat there and gathered dust after their little flurry. But it took White Christmas to bring them out of hiding. And then after that, every year for the next 10 years, everybody was, well, not everybody, lots of no-name songwriters were trying to grab the brass ring.
Those songwriters of Santa Claus is Coming to Town were J. Fred Coots and Haven Gillespie. I don't know if they ever wrote another song, but we're going to...
They did, Rick.
What is it?
Yes, their other big song, can you imagine a song any more different, is You Go to My Head.
Oh, come on.
Serious.
Which is a great song.
Yeah, it's a great song, but how far can you get from Santa Claus is Coming to Town?
Wow, those men cover the waterfront, as they say. Talking to Charles Troy all the way up until 10 o'clock. We're going to take a little break, then we're going to get some news, and then we're going to talk more about Christmas music and his upcoming presentations. You can also, and you should, go to charlestroy.com. I'm not going to insult you by spelling that for you, but I will. charlestroy.com. It really... It's a full-blown website. You'll learn a great deal about him, but stay tuned, will you please? Welcome back. Rick Hogan, After Hours. My guest is Charles Troy. His website is also charlestroy.com. Around this time of year, Charles forsakes for a time his presentations about the fascinating history of various legendary Broadway musicals, Oklahoma, Chicago, Chorus Line, many, many, many. He does presentations all over this area and even in Michigan. On December 7th, he will be at the Skokie Theater. What's that show, Charles, if I have to ask?
That is Making a List, the Secular Songs of Christmas. And this is the show I mentioned that I created 5 years ago. And I was inspired by this book, White Christmas, The Story of an American Song. And what I challenged myself to do was to come up with a song that became a hit each successive year in the 10 years after White Christmas. Many of them mentioned by the author of this book, Jody Rosen, but I wanted a particular song from each year and make it kind of a cavalcade of...
What a great idea.
It gave it a structure, I must say. And so I was able to come up with a song from each year, then discover by doing the research, and I've got another book here that's called Angels We Have Heard, the Christmas Song Stories, and many of the stories that I found were in this book.
How do you figure, just because it was Tin Pan Alley and such people were drawn to that White Christmas written by Irving Berlin, who was Jewish, A number of the top-selling Christmas songs of all time were written by Jews. Was it the nature? Was it just, hey, whoever's in this office, I need a Christmas song by next Thursday?
No, not so much. It was mostly that these were the guys who were writing popular songs. A number of them weren't written by Jews.
But right,
I just
of
think
course.
A preponderance of writers in that particular
sure.
field were Jewish,
sure.
and so they went for it. One of the amusing stories is one of the most successful Christmas songwriters is the guy who wrote Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and he wrote it. His name is Johnny Marks, Jewish, because he was the brother-in-law of the fellow who wrote the original story, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Oh.
And he wrote that story right here in Chicago for Montgomery Ward.
That I knew.
Yeah.
That
he
I knew.
He worked in the advertising department of Montgomery Ward, and his boss liked some parodies that he had written for some employee party. And he said, see what you can do. See what you can do with a Christmas book, because we'd like to distribute it to all the Montgomery Ward stores throughout the country. So his name was Bob May, and he thought about it, and he thought, okay, what's it going to be? Okay, it should be about some sort of animal.
Sure.
And what animal could it be? Well, it's the holidays, it's cold, so he came up with the idea of a reindeer. But then he said, okay, so what's different about this reindeer? And he thought, in fact, he thought this because he was living on the north side, and he looked at the streetlights one day, and he said, of course, it's his nose. It's his shiny nose. Go ahead.
Don't you – I'm not going to call all of these guys geniuses, but there is something of genius or innovation or wild creativity involved in a story like that.
Yeah. That's what fascinates me.
And you yourself as a songwriter, too, you must greatly admire some of these tunesmiths.
I admire the creativity, and that's what fascinates me about the stories that I tell, that I figure out where the inspiration came from, and then we see where it led.
I must assume that people – because I've written about this once, and not nowhere is a newspaper story. It's not in depth at all, but it was fascinating to me that in your presentations and when people hear these stories, that has to enrich for them the song that is just sort of going straight in one ear and out the other during this crazy season.
Yeah, I've been told that my presentations really add meaning to various things, to musicals, to songs, to et cetera. And obviously it's very gratifying to hear that. But back to Bob May for a second. This is a funny story. So he comes up with the idea of Rudolph has this shiny nose, which he then makes his red nose. He takes it to his boss at Montgomery Ward, and Montgomery Ward hears that this reindeer has a red nose, and he says, come on, Bob. He's this advertising guy, and he's thinking not of reindeer. He's thinking of W.C. Fields.
Yeah, right,
right,
right.
You've got a drunken reindeer here. Come on. So Bob May figures, okay, I've got to convince my boss before anything else. He takes a Montgomery Ward colleague of his, a layout artist. They go to Lincoln Park Zoo, and they study reindeer, and Bob May has his friend draw until he gets a reindeer he's satisfied with. He brings it back to his boss, and he said, here's what he looks like, and his name is Rudolph. And his boss says, okay, go ahead, Bob, write the story.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. What is the most popular Christmas song of all time? Is it White Christmas?
Yeah, it has to be White Christmas.
Yeah.
Especially because it triggered all these other songs.
What do you think of that as a song?
Oh, I think it's fabulous. And more important, Irving Berlin, well, not more important, but he thought it was a fabulous song, too. In fact, he was so excited after he wrote it that he came into his office the next day, and he normally didn't show up until the afternoon because he was an insomniac who stayed up all night writing stuff, and then he would sleep in the morning. But he was so excited he couldn't go to sleep, brings the song to his office, and tells his musical secretary. And his musical secretary was necessary because Berlin couldn't write music. He basically had to dictate
his
tunes. So anyway, he tells his musical secretary, not only is this the best song I've ever written, it's the best song anybody ever wrote.
Well, no ego there. No ego there for Mr. Berlin.
He was pretty proud of it, that's for sure.
Do you, when What do people want to know? I mean, I know you talk to and you really do interact with the crowd after, especially after these Christmas things. What are they desperate to know?
Well, I think, you know, honestly, because a lot of my demographic is Jewish, a lot of them are very intrigued with the fact that so many songs have been written by Jewish songwriters. So in my presentation, I incorporate which ones were so they kind of know. And each of these stories is kind of different from the others, and they paint a picture. But there are two stories in a row that are actually fairly similar. 1945, which is Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow, and 1946, which is the Christmas song, both written in California on very hot days in the middle of the summer. But I also say there is one other similarity, that both of them were written by Jewish prodigies from Chicago, Let It Snow was written by Sammy Kahn, but also by Julie Stein,
sure,
who grew up here and played piano with the Chicago Symphony at age 9. The next year, the Christmas song was written, of course, by Mel Torme, who also grew up in Chicago, and he sang at the Black Hawk Restaurant at age 4.
See, ladies and gentlemen, how could you not want to go to the Skokie Theater on December 7th, no matter what holiday you celebrate? It is just so interesting, Charles Troy, and you do, as you've been listening to him, make the scholarship, the considerable scholarship that has gone into your presentation, so alive and so palpably fun. We got to take a little break, and then I'm going to ask Charles to pick a song for you to hear. You obviously, Charles, in the shows, play snippets or whole songs. Mm-hmm. You have someone special coming on December 7th, right?
Yes. I'm going to be sharing the stage with Daniel Johnson, a portly fellow with a long white beard.
Oh, no, that's Santa Claus. What do you mean?
Well, he certainly plays Santa Claus a lot, and I'd like to have live performances in my presentations, so I asked him to sing one song, Let It Snow, and also a parody of Santa Claus Is Coming to Town that I actually wrote in high school at Evanston that turned out to be totally appropriate to this presentation. He's not here. I don't sing. Come December 7th and hear it.
We'll be right back. We only have a few more minutes left with Charles Troy, who I know has been not just enlightening you, but entertaining you. You can spend more time with him at the Skokie Theater on December 7th, where he's giving his Christmas music presentation with Daniel Johnson, a portly man who looks like Santa Claus, I guess, and will sing. He's a cabaret artist as well. You can also go to charlestroy.com to see where else he's going to be. So, Mr. Christmas song, the smartest man I know about the business of Christmas music, do you have, I don't want to put you on the spot, but do you have a favorite Christmas song and why?
I think you did just put me on the spot, didn't you?
Or two or three that you like. I mean, I'll let you off the spot.
Well, why don't I talk about the first one? Because it's the song I used in my parody. It's the song that really triggered the whole thing. And I think in some ways, it's maybe the most pervasive other than the White Christmas, and it's Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. And as I say, that was written by these two fellows, Haven Gillespie and J. Fred Coots, and it was written originally by assignment, and it was written on a subway train in New York. And my thought was, when you hear the recording that I'm going to play, you can hear how perhaps the clacking of the subway train influenced Haven Gillespie in the kind of tune that he wrote. It's really kind of like a march / foxtrot.
Fascinating. Here you go, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. along the Milky Way. I stopped off at the North Pole to spend a holiday. I called on dear old Santa Claus to see what I could see. He took me to his workshop and told his plans to me. So you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, checking it twice, gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been good or bad, so be good for goodness sake. Oh, you better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
That is a great song. I actually don't remember ever hearing that, the kind of first words to that song.
No, it's never sung. But, you know, back in the day, you always had to have a verse for a recording of a song. So they wrote one, and this was the first recording of it in 1934
wow.
by a recording artist named Harry Reeser. Now, there's a name that everybody knows so well, Harry Reeser. So, and the song did nothing. Just did nothing. And then, you know, 8 years ago comes White Christmas, and suddenly everybody's singing this song.
Wow. You know, one of the things, too, I think you know better than I, that you know, this was coming out of these songs were written coming out of the Depression and a World War, and they really did, I think, you know, this explosion helped evoke feelings of childhood and pleasantness before all the unpleasantness.
That's true, although... Haven Gillespie's idea was he was a kid in Kentucky from a poor family of 10 children, and his mother said to her unruly brood, you better all be careful or else Santa Claus won't come this year.
Wow.
So basically that was his inspiration.
Charles Troy, you're an amazing guy. You make learning fun, and these are not learning lessons. These are ways to enrich the holiday experience that we all now think of as overly commercialized, and it might even get you over the, you know, your feelings about the election and all that jazz. Charles, keep in touch. Go to the website, charlestroy.com, and also go to the Skokie Theater on December 7th, where you will see as Charles describes
it. 1:30
in the afternoon. Could not be more convenient. That's the perfect way to start the holidays. Charles, it's great to see you. Mrs. Troy, it is great to meet you. You sit here, and they've been married, I think, 42 years, which is a miracle, a Christmas miracle in itself. Yes, yeah, you've been married twice. We'll be right back.